Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
It is April the 22nd, the 15th day of the Omer, and we are in... What's that?
I said for a little bit longer.
For a little bit longer, right. And we are in Parshas Bo. It's our first class since Pesach. We're on page 342. And we're up to Pasuk Yud Beis, verse 12. It's after Moshe has warned Paro about the plague of locusts. And Paro first said, nothing doing. And then the servants of Paro told Paro, this is enough already. So he called the Moshe Aaron back. And he offered them to leave, but to keep behind the children. Leave without the children, and Moshe, and then he threw them out. He didn't listen anymore to Moshe and Aaron. So, of course, that's not acceptable, and therefore the plague is now about to come. Vayomer Hashem al Moshe, Hashem says to Moshe, Nte yadcha al eretz Mitzrayim bo'ar be, stretch out your hand upon the land of Egypt in locusts, which means that in doing so you will bring the locusts. And we've seen before that when it says he stretched out his hand, what is he holding?
The staff.
Stretch out your hand means with the staff. V'ya'al al eretz Mitzrayim, it will bring them up onto the land of Egypt. V'yochal ot kol esef haaretz, it will eat, it meaning the locusts, will eat all of the grass of the land. Eis kol asher hishir ha'barad, whatever remained after the hail. You'll recall from Parshas Va'era, that the hail destroyed anything that was hard, because hail is hard, and when it struck anything that was hard, it broke it. But those things that were soft, which were not yet fully ripe, and therefore they were soft, the hail did not destroy them. So there was still some food, although there was a food shortage, but there still was some food in Egypt. The locusts are going to create a famine. They're going to come and eat all that remained from the hail. Vayet Moshe es matehu al eretz Mitzrayim. Moshe stretched out his hand over the land of Egypt. VaHashem nihag ruach kadim ba'aretz. Hashem led or brought about, how do they say it here?
Guided.
Guided, okay. An eastern wind, easterly wind, over the land. Kol hayom ahu v'kol halayla. All that day and all the night. Haboker hayah. The morning had come, Veruach HaKadim Nasa Etarbe, and the eastern wind had brought the locusts. So Hashem brought an easterly wind, which blew for perhaps it was 24 hours, but it was the bulk of the day plus the night. So maybe it was a full 24, but it certainly was a long time. And with that wind came the locusts. Now it's interesting to note that this is the first time that we find that the wind brings the plague.
Right.
Till now, we've had the frogs come up out of the Nile. Mm-hmm. We've had the ground turn into lice. We've had the animals just show up with the wild beasts. We had the boils, which was when Moshe took the ashes and threw them up to the heavens, and then they spread out over Egypt and they came down with boils. Here you have a natural phenomenon, the wind blowing in the locusts. It's interesting to think about why at this stage, because as we've seen, the plagues have become increasingly more of indicative of Hashem's power over nature. As we've pointed out many times, we've gone from the beneath the ground to on top of the ground to airborne, to show Hashem's complete mastery over all of the elements, over all of nature. So you would have thought that there shouldn't be some sort of a natural cause here of the blowing of the wind, because one could argue that this isn't a plague, this is just the wind blowing in the locusts. Now, only one who wants to close their eyes to Hashem would argue that this is anything, but they argue that this is natural. Because there are so many other indications that it's not natural. Number one, Moshe predicted it accurately. And as we will see, the locusts also behaved in a manner that would not have been natural. As we'll see that, coming up. But nevertheless, there is some sort of natural phenomenon of the wind which is blowing in the locusts. Yes?
I always get confused, even if I'm listening to a weather forecast, when it says an east wind.
Good.
Yeah.
Okay.
Doesn't it usually come from the west?
I don't know what it means in a weather forecast.
Yep.
Here it means a blowing from the east.
From the east. Okay.
So it's coming from the east.
That's right.
Is it coming from Israel directionally?
Yeah, that's what we'll see about that. We'll see about that. So it's coming from the east. Whenever you see directions of wind in the Chumash, it's referring to where it's coming from.
Thank you.
But doesn't it usually come from the west?
Can come any wind can come from all directions. It may be more prevalent in different parts of the world. Winds blow more prevalently in different ways and different seasons as well.
Is there also significance the fact that it says all day and all night, because that also is not being descriptive of any of the plagues?
Yeah, it seems to have been a powerful wind that blew for a long time, that blew in the locusts.
Isn't that the same as Yom Suf?
Yeah, so we haven't gotten there yet.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
Over there we're going to find that a wind also blows prior to the splitting of the sea. Right. Vayal ha'arbeh al kol eretz Mitzrayim. The locusts came up upon the entire land of Egypt. Vayonach b'chol givul Mitzrayim. And it rested in all of the boundaries of Egypt. So this seems redundant. First it says that they came up upon all the land of Egypt, and they settled in all the boundaries of Egypt. Why emphasize the boundaries of Egypt? Right. Okay, so as we've seen before, here we have another example of this, where the plague remained in the boundaries of Egypt and in fact was a way of settling disputes over boundaries, because they didn't go into neighboring countries. And that's one of the ways that the locusts did not act naturally. Obviously, a plague of locusts normally would not differentiate between the boundary of the country. Wherever there's food, they'll go. But here, they stopped at the border of Egypt. Kaved ma'od, it was very heavy. Lefanav lo haya kein arba kamohu, that beforehand there was no locust like it. Ve'acharav lo yakein, and afterwards there will not be like it. Now, in the later in history, as reported, just to make sure I get this right, as reported in the book of Yoel, which is one of the Treyasa, one of the 12, one of the 12 shorter prophets, there is a plague of locusts that exceeds this one. However, over there, it's many different types of locusts. There are many different types of locusts that are involved in that plague. Here, it is only one species, the one called Arba. There are various types of locusts. In fact, we had it in this past week's Parsha. Parsha Shmini, which we read yesterday, talks about kosher and non-kosher locusts. There are locusts that are kosher to eat. We Ashkenazim typically don't eat them because we don't know, we don't have a direct transmission which locusts are the kosher ones and which ones are the non-kosher ones. But there are those who do have that transmission, and they are kosher. And locusts can be eaten, and those who are not careful with kosher food do eat locusts. It is a food that is eaten. In last week's Parsha, in Shmini, yesterday's Parsha, there was a discussion about the various types of locusts, various types of grasshoppers, if you will. Here, it was only one type. And that also was indicative of the fact that it was from God. Because if it would have been just a natural phenomenon, there's no reason why it should be one species. Typically, you'll have various types of locusts mixed in together. Here, it was one uniform type of locust. And this type, there had never been a swarm this size, and there will never be one, the Torah reports. It will never happen.
So is this a type that is kosher to eat, this Arbach type?
I believe this is kosher.
Yeah.
I believe so. I don't know. I mean, it depends on the, you know, it depends on the
chocolate. It's chocolate.
I'm sure the Chinese eat it. Oh.
I don't know, you know.
Depends on how hungry you are.
Don't they have them with chocolate? To make
I don't know. The Egyptians, I mean, these weren't chocolate coated when they came.
Even with chocolate.
Now, I think I mentioned to you before that I once read about a locust cloud that rose up out of the Indian Ocean onto the island of Madagascar, and it was a 7 mile wide locust cloud. This is larger than that. Right? So you imagine a 7 mile wide cloud of locusts descending upon an island. Here it was larger than that. It was a massive amount of locusts. All over Egypt, right.
Is Goshen included within the boundaries of Egypt?
Yes, but they were not. But they, as always, the Jews and their lands were not affected. Vayachasas ein kol haaretz. It covered the eye of the entire land, which means, as we saw in the case of the lice, it means you couldn't see the land. It covered the entire, any visual part of land was covered. Vatechshach haaretz. And the land was darkened. It became dark because of the locusts. Vayochal es kol esef haaretz. It consumed. It's referring to the locusts always in the singular because it's referring to the swarm of locusts. The swarm consumed all of the grass of the land. Ve'es kol pri ha'etz and all the fruit of the trees asher hosir ha'barad that had remained from the hail. Velonosar kol yerek ba'etz uve'esev ha'sadeh bechol eretz Mitzrayim. And there did not remain any vegetation at all amongst the trees and amongst the grasses of the fields in the entire land of Egypt. There was nothing left growing in all the lands of Egypt, which means any food that had not already been taken into one's home and safely stored away in some kind of a sealed container was totally consumed. There was nothing left growing in all the land of Egypt. Vayimaher Paro was quick. Likor lemoshe ul Aaron, to call to Moshe and to Aaron. Vayomer, and he said, Chatasi la Hashem elokeichem elokeichem. I have sinned to Hashem your God and to you. Is this the first time Paro was Sugazun has admitted that he sinned? Sugazun? It is not the first. Sugazun? It is the second time that he has admitted that he has sinned. The first time was with the hail, which was the previous,
right before
the previous plague. And if we'll compare how it says it over there, on page 338, a couple of pages ago, in Pasuk Chav Zayin 27, it says, Vayishlach Paro Vayikra Lemoshe Ula'aron. Paro sent and he called to Moshe and to Aaron. Vayomer Alem, he said to them, Chatasi Hapam. I have sinned this time. Hashem HaTzadik, Hashem is the righteous one. Vani Ve'ami HaRishoyim, and I and my nation are the evil ones. I have sinned this time. Here, first of all, he's quick to call to Moshe and Aaron, and he says, Chatasi LaHashem Elokeichem Elokeichem. I have sinned to Hashem your God and to you. He doesn't say, I've sinned at this time. This time sounds like one time. I sinned one time. Here already, he's admitting to multiple sins.
But he also recognizes Hashem in the way he
says. More, well, he said Hashem HaTzadik before as well, but he says, I've sinned to Hashem, your God, and to you. Back on page 342, Yud Zayin 17, V'ato enel so nocha tosi achapam, carry my sin but one more time. Meaning, forgive me this one time. Ve'atiru la'Hashem Elokeichem, and pray to Hashem your God. Ve'yoseh me'alai, and you shall remove from upon me rak es hamavet hazeh, only this death. It's interesting that he calls this plague a deathly plague. The locusts didn't kill anybody. Locusts don't kill. You don't have man-eating locusts. But they consumed all the food. So they caused death. And Paro is referring to all the plagues as deathly plagues. So remove from upon me only this death.
However, in this case, since everything's already been eaten,
mm-hmm.
So you remove the locusts.
What is it? Right.
Back.
And it's going to happen.
Right.
How's it going to?
It's going to happen.
Good. Now, Paro may have thought that there could still be some food.
Somewhere.
And what would the food have been?
Yusuf.
Locust.
The locust. Oh, the locust, yeah.
It, the food is eating food.
Right.
But you can keep the food. They ate the food. Right.
They could eat the cattle.
Or the cattle, if there's any left, right. Vayetzemeim Paro. And he left from before Paro. Moshe left Paro.
Why did I say he if they were both there?
Who, Moshe and Aaron?
Because he summoned Moshe and Aaron.
Yeah. Moshe is the main one, so it says in the singular. Vayetar el Hashem, and he prayed to God. Vayahafok Hashem ruach yom, and Hashem turned around a westerly wind, blowing from the west, chazak ma'od, very strong. Vayisayetar ben, it carried the locust. Vayiskaehu yama suf, and they translated it as hurled it toward the sea of reeds. Lo nishar arbe echad b'chol givul mitzrayim, there did not remain even one locust in all the land of Egypt. So every single locust was blown out of the land of Egypt. Rashi says in the name of our sages that even those locusts that the Egyptians themselves caught, because it wouldn't be very hard to catch a locust, right? Just scoops them up, and put away for themselves to eat, even those got blown out of Egypt. There was nothing left. Every single locust was blown out of Egypt, which explains why, when God brought the plague, and it talks about the easterly wind, it says, Hashem directed an easterly wind all that day and that night. But it does not tell us that the wind was strong. It just says there was a wind. There was a steady easterly wind which blew in the locusts. Here it says there was a westerly wind that was very strong. This one was gale force, which means that this one actually blew things around, where the easterly wind that blew in the locusts didn't necessarily knock down power lines when the locusts were blown in. It just was a very steady wind that just kept on going until the locusts came in. But the westerly wind was a hurricane force. And therefore, it blew through the Egyptians' homes. And Hashem, of course, caused that wind to blow whatever they had tickled. So if they had taken some locusts and put them in a jar, the wind would blow that jar, smash the jar, and the locusts would be blown away. And the wind was manipulated in a way that it would blow away every single locust, even those that were squirreled away by the Egyptians. By Chazek Hashem beslave Paro, Hashem strengthened the heart of Paro, v'lo shilach es b'nei Yisrael, he did not send away the Jewish people. Now, who mentioned the splitting of the sea? Was that you? Yeah, okay. So let's just compare the wind over here on page 342 with the locusts. Let's jump ahead to the splitting of the sea in Parshas Beshalach, where we'll see a very similar phrase. On page 372, in verse 21, Kaf Aleph. Vayet Moshe es yado al hayam, Moshe stretched his hand out over the ocean. Vayolech Hashem et hayam, and Hashem directed, moved, okay, the sea. Beruach kadim Azah, with a brazen eastern wind, or a strong eastern wind, how do they say it over here?
Strong
eastern wind. Azah, it can also mean brazen. It's a powerful wind. A powerful easterly wind. Kol halayla, all the night. Vayasem es hayam lecharavon, he put the sea to dry land. Vayibaku amayim, and the waters split. So here, it's also an easterly wind, but it's a powerful easterly wind. The word azah is used over here as a powerful easterly wind. So with the locusts, which what brought in the locusts was also an easterly wind, but it was not powerful. It was steady, and it was all day and all night, not just all night. It was a very long period of time that blew in the locusts. So let's understand the wind and how that works. So as Rashi explains, and
Mr. Sutton really alluded to it already, the land of Egypt is centers around the Nile River.
Mm-hmm.
That's the land of Egypt. And in fact, even today, the parts of Egypt that are green are around the Nile. The delta is fertile. And then as you move further down, it's really just a strip of green that goes along the Nile itself. So the country of Egypt follows the Nile. And the people lived in those days especially, along the Nile itself. The land of Israel, as we know, is over here. Now, I've mentioned this to you before, but it's worthwhile to point out again, that the current configuration of the state of Israel does not match up with the biblical boundaries of Israel itself. The biblical boundaries of Israel itself do not include the southerly part of the state of Israel. If you can picture the state of Israel, most of us are familiar with the map of Israel, the land of Israel juts down to the south and hits this arm of the Red Sea. Here's the Red Sea over here. And then the Red Sea has two arms or fingers that move off, that form the Sinai Peninsula. The state of Israel has a piece of land that juts south, meets the arm of the Red Sea over here, and that is where Eilat is, down over here. The reason why that's the way the partition plan worked out was to give Israel a port on the Red Sea. So that Israel, of course, has a port on the Mediterranean, many ports on the Mediterranean, but on the Red Sea, there would have been no way for Israel to have shipping without this port over here. The way that other countries over here are able to get to the Red Sea is through the Suez Canal, which is not necessarily available for the state of Israel. So this way there was a port on the Red Sea that the state of Israel has. But biblically, this part of the land is not really ours. This part of the land, it never was ours. It will be ours in the future, but biblically, it was never ours.
What's that?
No, the Plishtim are where the Gaza Strip is.
Okay.
That was also biblically not ours. It belonged to the Philistines, to the Plishtim. And this part down here belonged to Edom, to the children of Esau. The state of Israel biblically juts far south as far as Be'er Sheva. That's almost as far south as you get for the biblical boundary of Israel, which is not that far south. It's somewhere in here. And that's it. It does not go all the way down here. However, the biblical country of Israel includes not just the West Bank, which is biblically ours, but also the east bank of the Jordan, which is most of the country of Jordan, is biblically ours as well. Not only that, but the biblical country of Israel also juts further north and northeast, including all of where Lebanon is today and most of where Syria is today. So, you know, it's 6 and 1/2 of the other. You give up the southern part over here, but most of Lebanon, Syria, and Jordan also belong biblically to us. So this, whenever you get into discussions over whether we have a biblical claim to the land of Israel, you have to bear in mind that the boundaries we're talking about are completely different. There is the core part of Israel, which of course everybody understands is biblically something we can rely on. But if you're going to base yourself on the biblical boundaries, you have to give up the southern part of Israel and in fact take over Jordan, Syria, and Lebanon.
Is that the same territory that King David?
King David extended the boundaries further northeast. Most of Syria was taken over by King David. He annexed that to Israel.
That is true. That part of it was added later in the time of King David. But before King David, just from the boundaries that are stated in the Torah itself, you're still going to include most of Jordan, and you're also going to include most of Lebanon and still parts of Syria. He just moved further northeast in his conquest. Yeah.
Did King David do that by war?
Yeah. Now, the way that Rashi explains, which is in the name of Chazal of our sages, is that Hashem brought an easterly wind to bring the locusts was because Israel is towards the east of Egypt, slightly north as well, but it's primarily east of Egypt. And so he brought a wind as if to say, I'm going to come after you. You're starting up with me. I'm going to send my forces against you. So the easterly wind is coming from Israel to Egypt, blowing in the locusts. And that's why a wind is used. It's almost like Hashem is swinging a weapon. He's taking Israel and striking Egypt with Israel. You can't move land, but wind blows what is on one land to another land. So he is taking a weapon and essentially saying, okay, I'm going to take Israel and smack Egypt with Israel. And so the easterly wind blows the locusts. Now, where did the locusts actually come from? I don't know. It's possible they came up from part of the Red Sea. Rashi suggests that as a possibility. They came up from part of the Red Sea. But whatever it is, the locusts came and overran Egypt. When it's time for the locusts to be removed from Egypt, Hashem turns around the wind and blows the locusts west. But they actually are blown somewhat southwest because it says it blew them into the Sea of Reeds. That would be here.
Right.
Or here. One of these two. Mm-hmm. It blows the locusts into the water from Egypt. And that's the westerly wind coming from the west, blowing the locusts back out of Egypt. When the Red Sea splits, so a similar thing happens. There's a dispute over where the Jews crossed the Red Sea, exactly what happened. But the most simple way to understand it is that the Jews crossed this arm of the Red Sea. That they crossed from Egypt, this area here, into the Sinai Peninsula by going over an arm of the Red Sea. That's the simplest way to understand it. So Hashem also, to make that water split, brought an easterly wind, which would be coming from Israel. An easterly wind coming and causing the water to split and the Jews being able to walk through on dry land. Yeah.
While we have the map, where would Goshen be in Egypt?
I'm not 100% sure. My suspicion is it's somewhere in here, but I'm not 100% sure. And as I believe it is on the eastern bank, not on the western bank of the Nile, but I'm not sure where along the Nile River the land of Goshen would be.
Goshen.
Yeah. So my understanding is that it's becoming more personal because Paro now is going back on his word, where he said go, he threw them out. And he's becoming more and more. What's that?
Belligerent.
Aggressive. Thank you. More and more aggressive towards Moshe and Aaron. In the end, which we're about to see, he's actually going to throw them out and say, "Don't ever come back. I'm going to kill you." As he's taking out his frustrations directed at Moshe and Aaron. In his moments of humility over here, where he says, "I've sinned," he's including Moshe Aaron because he's really becoming more belligerent, more arrogant towards Moshe and Aaron, and more aggressive. So he's including them as well. Pasuk Chaf Aleph, verse 21, top of 344. So that's the eighth plague, following the same pattern as we've had before in the third, sixth, and sixth plagues. Now with the ninth plague, it's going to come without warning. Paro's already deserved a ninth plague as well. So here, Hashem is just going to tell Moshe to bring the ninth plague. Vayomer Hashem al Moshe, Hashem says to Moshe, Neten yadcha al hashamayim, stretch your hand out over the heavens. V'hi choshech al eretz Mitzrayim, there'll be darkness on the land of Egypt. V'yamesh choshech. Now that word v'yamesh is debated. Exactly what that word means. The art scroll here translates it as the darkness will be tangible, which is the way Rashi explains it. From the word mimashesh, which means to touch or to feel. You'll actually be able to feel the darkness. It won't just be dark that you can't see, but it'll be a tangible darkness. Vayet Moshe es yado al hashamayim. Moshe stretched his hands out over the heavens. And there was darkness, a complete darkness. Choshech means darkness. Afeila means thick darkness over all the land of Egypt for 3 days. Now, a thick darkness here means that it was so dark that normally, here we have to, this is one of these things which I'm going to have to explain based on what I know, but not what I experience. I happen to be night blind, which means my eyes don't adjust to the dark. So that, just to give you an example, what that means, when you are in a bright room and you walk into a dark room or you close the lights, and it takes a few seconds for your eyes to adjust to the dark, my eyes don't adjust. Those first few seconds, that's the way my eyes remain. That's what night blindness is. But you are all used to that in a dark room, you can see, after your eyes adjust, you can see shadows, you can make out forms, the things that you can see. More or less. Now the reason why you can do that, the reason why you're able to do that is because it's rare that it's actually pitch black. Usually there is some element of light somewhere, whether you're outside and it's coming from the moon and the stars, or street lamps, or whatever it is, or you're inside and there is some light somewhere in the house, that there's some glow coming from somewhere that does give off some element of light. And when your eyes adjust to the dark, then it's really an incredible thing, the way HaKadosh Baruch Hu created our eyes, that the eyes are able to pull that light in and be able to focus it and see whatever can be seen with that limited amount of light. When you're in a pitch black area where there's absolutely no light, then you're no better off than I am. Then, for instance, if a person's underground in one of those caves, going spelunking, and then the lights go out, right? Then there's nothing. There's absolutely nothing. There's nothing. So there's no way, even if your eyes normally would adjust to the dark, it wouldn't help you because there's no light to pull from in order to gather together into the eye to be able to see. So, The choshech afeila, the thick darkness at this point, just means that it was so dark that there was nothing that could be seen at all. They were all like I am regularly in the dark. There was no adjustment of their eyes to the dark because there was no light to bring in. So of course, for the Jews as we're about to see, it was light, but for the Egyptians, they couldn't see anything. Hashem removed all types of light. No moon, no stars, even their artificial lights, their cell phones, whatever it is, that gave off a little bit. Nothing. There was no glow that could be used in order for the Egyptians to be able to see anything. It was totally dark.
Even if they lived next to the Jews?
Even if they lived next to the Jews.
Yeah, and they say it was so thick that they couldn't see to stand up or sit down.
Okay, so that we haven't gotten to yet. That was just, so far, it was just that dark. Mm-hmm. Then the Torah says, Chaf Gimel 23, Lo ra'u ish et achiv, no man saw his brother, which means no one saw each other, v'lo kamu ish mitachtav, and no man got up from under himself, which means no one was able to stand. Shlosh es yamim, for 3 days. Ulechol b'nei Yisrael, but for all the Jews, hayor b'moshvosam, there was light in all of their dwellings. So here, as Mrs. Starkman just said, there was actually 6 days of darkness. The first three was pitch black. But the next three was so dark that this is where you can actually feel the darkness. It was like being in quicksand. It was like being in some sort of a mud. They couldn't move. The darkness had it was tangible. There was some feeling to it, and you couldn't move. It was like an ooze, the darkness, and it kept them from moving. Now, clearly, scientifically, we would not be able to explain that, because we understand scientifically that darkness is the absence of light. The natural state is dark, and you have light which illuminates the darkness. So if you remove the light, it gets dark. But that isn't going to give the darkness any sort of
quality,
right? You won't be able to feel it. It's just going to be dark. You can't see. It's like you have your eyes closed or blindfolded.
Here it says the darkness lasted only for 3 days.
The Torah mentions the Torah mentions 3 days twice. First it says in Pasuk Chavez verse 22 that it was very dark for 3 days, and then in Chav Gimel 23 it says they couldn't get up for 3 days. So the commentators explain that it was 3 and 3.
So they had been fasting. Basically, there was no food.
Well, the first 3 days, if they could find it, if they could feel it, they could eat it.
Still eat it.
Right.
Okay. But
right.
There's no food. The locusts took care of them.
Well, you know, like we said, they may have been able to kill animals or milk a cow or, you know, whatever, you know.
Would have been fine.
Yeah.
So which 3 days were the Jews?
But they could also buy food from the Jews. Just like with the blood, they were able to buy water. I think it was food. Which
thing? Okay. What was that? That was the bottle of water, plastic bottle of water. So which of the 3 days were the Jews who were shamed at the mistreatment?
Okay, so we're going to get to that. So yes.
So that was something that I was going to ask, because if the Egyptians were aware that all these plagues were just hitting on them and not on the Jews, why couldn't they go over to the Jewish area where the Jews were living and be free of the plague?
Right. So just as with the blood, where the Egyptians couldn't get away from it. Even if they would try to drink out of the same cup as a Jew, while the Jew was drinking, the Jew would get water in his mouth and the Egyptian would get blood in his mouth. They couldn't beat the system. If they would go over to the Jewish side, the darkness would engulf them, would follow them. They wouldn't be able to see. This is even during the day. They couldn't see.
So they were begging the Jews, basically.
They were what?
They had to beg the Jews to bring it to them.
Yeah. So just to address the fact that the darkness was tangible, I do want to point out that we know that the natural state of things is dark, and then light dispels the darkness. So outer space, for example, is naturally dark. And then if you're near a star, or there's light coming from a star, that will light up that area of space. The Gemara tells us a little bit of a different approach. It doesn't change anything practically for us, but conceptually, there is a little bit of a different take that the Gemara has. The Gemara says that the natural state of things is to be light. That's the natural state of things. However, Hashem creates darkness to cover up that light. Now, we're not talking here about the light of the sun or the light of some sort of artificial light, but there is some sort of an unearthly light, some sort of a spiritual light, which is the natural state of things. That's what we would say that blankets everything. That's the first layer. Then Hashem creates darkness that covers up all of that. And then, on top of the darkness, this is a third layer, you have the sun, fire, artificial light that we create, or light that is created in nature, that dispels that level of darkness so we can see. But if you think about it, I'm saying it in layers just to conceptualize it, that think of a blanket of light, which is then covered by a blanket of dark, so you can't see the blanket of light. And in order to make light, you need something else on top of it to make light, and that's going to be the sun, or fire, or you know, whatever flashlights or whatever it is that's going to create light.
Are both lights the same?
No, no. The natural, the original light is much brighter and much more. You know, that would be the light that will Mirsa Hashem see in the future. That's the powerful light. Right.
So now, why isn't that explained in Bereishis in creation?
Well, it's explained somewhat because it says that God said there should be light.
Mm-hmm.
What was there before light?
Well, darkness.
Well, it does say there was darkness, but the Gemara says that Hashem generates the darkness. There's darkness being generated from someplace.
You think of Hashem himself as light, right? I
mean, that's right. Yeah. Right. Even though Hashem, you can't think of Hashem as light, because Hashem, you can't think of anything.
Yeah, right.
But
yeah.
The Gemara says that the inner sanctum, wherever that is light. The natural state is light. The reason why I say this is because since we picture darkness as the absence of light, but if you look at, which is true, and this is not contradicting that, it's the absence of this layer of light that is created, right? The light that illuminates the darkness. But if you think of darkness as something that is also being generated, mm-hmm. well, it can be generated as just dark, or it can be generated as thick and be tangible and be something that also inhibits movement, not just vision. It's something that's being produced, then it can also be produced in a thicker way. That's the only point I'm trying to make, that darkness is being produced, and therefore, if Hashem so chooses, which He did over here, it can be produced in a way that is thicker and prevents the mobility of the
evil. Well, sometimes you have dark matter.
Yeah, there's dark matter.
Yeah.
Right, whatever that means.
That's an idea.
So, our sages tell us that this plague of darkness was served two functions other than to punish the Egyptians. As all of the plagues were punishing the Egyptians, so too the darkness punished the Egyptians. But this is the last of the normal, quote-unquote, plagues. None of the plagues are normal. But it was the last of the plagues that were there simply to plague the Egyptians. Because the tenth plague is there to let the Jews go. That's going to be the death of the firstborn. So that's separate. But of the nine plagues, darkness is the last of those plagues that are there simply to plague the Egyptians. For no other reason, as we learned before, than to show Hashem's mastery over everything. Over the Egyptians, over nature, over everything. Being that this is the last one, there are two things that need to happen prior to the Jews getting out of Egypt. One is the Jews being able to take possession of the wealth of the Egyptians. Remember that the country of Egypt was by far the wealthiest country in the world, having become incredibly wealthy because of the years of famine where everybody had to come to Egypt to buy food from Yosef, and the country became fabulously wealthy. So the Jews had to get a hold of that wealth. We'll talk about why in a moment. And the other thing that had to happen is that the Jews who were not worthy of leaving Egypt needed to die so that they would not leave Egypt, but that it would happen in a way where it would diminish the effect of the Jews leaving Egypt in the least possible way. Meaning, the Jews leaving Egypt is a phenomena it's shocking. It's incredible what happened over here. And with the next plague, the death of the firstborn, it's going to be such a dramatic plague with such a dramatic exodus that the entire world is going to hear about it and be amazed. If Jews are going to die and not leave Egypt, that's going to diminish that drama. That's going to take away from it, because it's going to mean that, well, not all the Jews left. It wasn't so stupendous. So if there are going to be Jews who are not going to leave Egypt, they have to be removed from the scene in a way that will not mitigate the incredible exodus that is about to happen. So he couldn't wait until the 10th plague. It couldn't be that at the 10th plague, the firstborn Egyptians would die, the Jews would leave, and also those Jews who don't deserve to leave will die. Then it will remove the incredible plague that happened the way the Jews left. So they have to be removed in the quietest way possible. The quietest way possible is during the plague of darkness when the Egyptians won't know what's going on. Is it true that after the plague is over, the Egyptians will finally be able to see? They will notice that there are fewer Jews, and they may even recognize some Jews that are no longer there. Yes, it wasn't something which was a secret, but it was done in the quietest way possible that will least affect the dramatic exodus that's about to happen. So these two things need to be addressed.
Yes. Is there a number on those?
Yes, yes. We need to talk about the smallest estimate is 80% of the Jews. It's a lot of people. A lot of people. Four-fifths.
But I thought they did not want to go.
What's that?
I thought they did not want
to go. Yes, well, we have to talk about that. Why wouldn't they want to go? So these are two things that need to be discussed. The wealth that the Jews had to get from the Egyptians and the death of the Jews who didn't want to leave. So first of all, the wealth, just the first point to make about that, is to look back at the Bris Ben Abisarim, the covenant between the halves, with Avraham, where this whole thing is foretold. And in the Bris Ben Abisarim, Hashem says explicitly to Avraham that they will leave with great wealth. So that is, if you want to see it, I will read it to you, but if you want to look at it yourself, it is on page 68. And we read it during the Seder. That's right. It is quoted in the Haggadah.
It's the fulfillment of this.
Yeah. Yeah. On page 68, verse 14, it says, "V'gam et hagoy asher yavodu don anochi," and also in this nation that they serve, I will judge. And then they will leave with great wealth. They did not take the Egyptians' wealth during the plague of darkness. They didn't take the wealth. They're going to take it later. It'll be explicit later on that they will take the wealth of the Egyptians. However, they used the plague of darkness to their advantage, that they were able to go into all of the Egyptians' homes and all of their places where they kept things and search through everything without fear of being discovered themselves and found all of their wealth. And in this manner, when it was time to leave Egypt and they demanded the wealth of Egypt as they left, the Egyptians could not deny their wealth. Jews were able to say, "I'd like your 12 gold pieces that you have in your sock drawer in the back left corner, or in your sugar bowl, or wherever you hide your 12 gold pieces." They were able to say it specifically and explicitly, and the Egyptians couldn't avoid it. Why did they need to leave with great wealth? Well, Hashem told Avram they would leave with great wealth. So in a very simple explanation, the Jews, they suffered. Hashem tells Avram they're going to suffer, but then they're going to become very wealthy. So maybe you wouldn't want to suffer and you wouldn't want to be wealthy, but they had to suffer. So after the suffering, there'll be great wealth. The Gemara tells us that later on in history, in the time of Alexander the Great, the Egyptians brought a lawsuit against the Jews, claiming that the Jews had taken all of their wealth and compounded interest over many years. The Jews ought to owe the Egyptians much money. And they brought this lawsuit to Alexander the Great. The Jews couldn't deny it. It's explicit in the Torah. And that's what they said. They said, "Your Torah states it explicitly that you took our wealth."
But they weren't paid during the years of service to
you. So the Gemara says that a man by the name of Kviya ben Pesisa responded. He was the one who led the Jewish defense team. And he turned the tables on the Egyptians because he said that, well, let's figure out how many years the Jews worked for the Egyptians, and how many Jews worked, millions of people, over a period of over 100 years. Let's figure out the wages of all those people for all those years. And let's see who owes whom money. And in fact, if you make that calculation, it actually turns the tables. And the Egyptians would actually come out owing the Jews money. When this happened, Alexander was about to fine the Egyptians and make them pay more money to the Jews. And they ran off and to avoid the sentencing that was going to happen from that lawsuit. So the taking of the wealth of the Egyptians in a certain way is justifiable because of the fact that the Egyptians enslaved us without any just cause. Yes?
I was going to ask something about it.
Okay. Yeah?
Is this something that Alexander the Great has written down? Or
I don't know. The Gemara says it.
Oh, the Gemara.
Yeah. It's the Gemara in Maseches Sanhedrin, Tractate Sanhedrin. Tell the story.
It would be an interesting acknowledgement on the part of the Egyptians and all of this itself.
Yes. Well, recently there was a kangaroo court that was set up that brought a lawsuit against the Jews for taking the wealth of the Egyptians in the past 10 years.
In Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
Again.
In Egypt.
They tried it again.
So the Gemara itself tells us the answer. Now, there is, of course, one has to also understand whether the current people living in Egypt are the physical descendants of those Egyptians. That's an open question. We know we are descendants of Jews. We don't know that they are descendants of Egyptians. So that's not necessarily clear. But whatever it is, the Gemara itself says this is not the year 19 whatever it was 1990s whatever. If you look, you can find it. It happened. This is not the first time that this line of reasoning was attempted, and it was refuted back then. It can be refuted again in the same way.
I heard of a seder. I'm sorry, I cannot remember. But at one time, when the Jews were in Egypt, were the Egyptians white, and afterwards
were the Egyptians.
Black,
I'm sorry.
White skin.
Oh, I.
And then there were black previously or black afterwards. I mean, there were different types of Egyptians too.
Yeah, the Egyptians were the way it's described in Parshas Noach.
Oh, yes,
the Egyptians
right.
are descendants of Ham,
so
which would indicate a darker skinned nation. Yes, and in fact, in Parshas Lech Lecha, Rashi tells us that they were darker.
Right.
Exactly how dark? Who knows? I mean, that's. It's hard to know. And anyway, there's been so much, mixing of cultures over the years, it doesn't necessarily indicate it. Okay, so that is at least a preliminary discussion about the wealth part of it. But we still need to talk about the death of the Jews who were not willing to leave, and a little bit further, a little bit more discussion about the wealth as well, which has to be discussed. So please go next week, we'll continue with the discussion.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.